and welcome to Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters, and today we'll examine a number of stories and issues in the news. We'll begin with the Hide No Harm Act, introduced in the Senate today by Senators Blumenthal and Casey, that would establish criminal penalties for corporate executives who, up until now, the Justice Department has settled for with fines instead of criminal charges under deferred prosecution agreements. Ronald White, the Director of Regulatory Policy at the Center for Effective Government, joins us to discuss whether in an environment where massive fraud has been conducted by Volkswagen executives, where the DOJ settled with GM over faulty ignition switches linked to 124 deaths, and Merck and Johnson & Johnson withheld information on the risks their drugs posed, might it be possible to send top executives to jail now? Then we will speak with Robert Kuttner, the co-editor and co-founder of The American Prospect and the author of Debtor's Prison, The Politics of Austerity versus Possibility. He joins us to discuss his article at the Huffington Post, Bernie Sanders is about as radical as Harry Truman, and his belief that Donald Trump will be the likely Republican nominee for president, which will make the race something of a cakewalk for Hillary Clinton if she is the Democratic nominee, assuming Biden does not spoil her chances. And it will be a much more interesting race in 2016 if Bernie Sanders becomes the Democratic nominee. Then finally, we'll examine the legacy of Arne Duncan, who just stepped down as Secretary of Education, and speak with David Halperin, a senior fellow at Republican Report, who has an article at the Huffington Post, Report Exposes For-Profit College Abuses in Converting to Nonprofits. We will discuss why the $30-plus billion-a-year for-profit college racket was able to continue on Duncan's watch, with aspiring students and vets defrauded with worthless diplomas and indentured with student debt, all the while as the taxpayers being ripped off, completely subsidizing these corporate criminals. And joining us now is Ronald White, who is the Director of Regulatory Policy at the Center for Effective Government. He also serves in the Departments of Environmental Health Sciences, Epidemiology and Health Policy and Management at the Johns Hopkins Bloomberg School of Public Health, and as a member of the State of Maryland's Air Quality Control Advisory Board. Welcome to Background Briefing, Ronald White.
Thank you. Nice to be with you.
And Senator Blumenthal has put forth a bill today titled Hide No Harm, and this is a bill that's in response to General Motors' recall scandal in which ignition switch defects were linked to 124 deaths, yet the Department of Justice gave them a deferred prosecution agreement, which meant that nobody went to jail, a fine was paid, but no criminal charges were levied against any corporate officers. And this is a pattern that's been going on for some time. What do you think the chances are of anybody on the Republican side taking this seriously in the Senate? I mean, it's obviously a very overdue move on the part of the senator, but in that gridlock environment, what's the chances here?
Well, I mean, I think there is interest, frankly, in some quarters of the more moderate Republican community on Capitol Hill, recognizing that we've seen a rash of this kind of behavior from the large corporations. And you just mentioned the GM example, but Toyota Motor Vehicles had unintended acceleration that caused problems relating to speeding cars unexpectedly that led to deaths and accidents that Toyota was fined a significant amount of money for. But the bottom line is that for a large corporation like that, it's just a drop in the bucket. And as you point out, the case with General Motors, no single corporate executive was found personally responsible for those kinds of problems. We have the similar situation with Takata airbags in motor vehicles, where a knowingly defective product that's led to deaths and accidents and injuries, you know, has occurred. And again, no specific corporate individual has been held accountable. So this is certainly a pattern. I think people are outraged by it, and there's certainly hope that at least more moderate Republicans who recognize this particular problem will join with Senator Blumenthal and Senator Casey, who co-sponsored, that's Senator Bob Casey from Pennsylvania, who co-sponsored this legislation with Senator Blumenthal, and that they'll support this bill.
Well, one would think in the environment of all these unfolding scandals involving Volkswagen and their decision to defraud consumers and actually defraud the government in the sense that the subsidies were given for on the basis that these were green cars when in fact the exhausts were rigged to give the impression that they were green. And that's very much in front of the public. And of course, there's been the cases of Merck with Vioxx, Simplicity Cribs. You mentioned Toyota. There was also the Huffington Post investigation into Johnson & Johnson, where they pushed a drug that they knew caused strokes and abnormal breasts in young men. So there's been a rash of it. How does that fit in with the recent conviction of the head of the peanut company down in Georgia, who actually got jail time?
Well, actually, I'm glad, you know, it's interesting you brought that up. I've actually just posted a blog on our Center for Effective Government website today that actually contrasts the cases that we've just been talking about with the Peanut Corporation of America case, where here you have a small, relatively small corporation where its senior management deliberately disseminated contaminated food product that led to several deaths and a lot of people getting sick. And the president of the company received a sentence of 28 years in jail. And other members of the corporation received jail sentences ranging from a few years to 20 years for contributing to that kind of problem in terms of food poisoning. So it's an interesting contrast, and basically what it shows is that large corporations have been getting unfavorable treatment under our judicial system, and this legislation is an effort to correct that that two-track system that we seem to have in our justice Department of Justice, where large corporations are allowed to, as you point out, have these deferred criminal prosecution agreements where they're not charged, where the corporation basically gets to go off scot-free as long as they meet the terms of the settlement agreement, whereas smaller corporations, where legitimately there are outrageous criminal actions, receive appropriate penalties, like the ones we were just talking about for the Peanut Corporation of America.
And again, I'm speaking with Ronald White, who's the Director of Regulatory Policy at the Center for Effective Government. He also serves in the Departments of Environmental Health Sciences, Epidemiology, and Health Policy and Management at the Johns Hopkins Bloomberg School of Public Health, and is a member of the State of Maryland's Air Quality Control Advisory Council. So why is it, though, that the Justice Department, which is, I imagine it's the executive branch, the White House, could they not step in and just basically say, look, enough of these deferred prosecution agreements? I mean, after all, going back to the 2008-2009 near-death experience with the global economy and the massive crash that cost $13 trillion and wiped out about $9 trillion worth of home equity, virtually nobody went to jail there. It's not as if this has not been pretty evident for the longest time that there's been this mechanism where huge fines are paid, but nobody goes to jail.
Well, and in fact, the Department of Justice just in the past month or so, a little over a month, did come out with a new statement of policy saying that they're going to really sort of scale back their use of these kinds of deferred prosecution agreements, these settlement agreements, and urging, you know, their members of their departments to basically take a harder look at these cases to see whether, in fact, individuals should be held accountable as individuals as opposed to the corporation. So I think there is at least some discussion of that and some recognition that this is a problem. But again, it leaves it up to individual prosecutors to decide whether or not to enter into these deferred prosecution agreements. And what this bill would do would be to say, no, when you've got deliberate cover-up or malfeasance on the part of a corporation in which they knowingly hide a defective product or service, something that's going to harm the public or their workers, that those folks should be held criminally liable for their actions. And that the penalties that and the fines that are levied should be levied against them personally, not against the corporation, which has huge resources.
So how do these bills that are put forth, like the Hide No Harm Act that Senator Blumenthal and Senator Casey put forth today, How do they fare in an election year? Would it be reasonable to assume that Bernie Sanders and others might jump aboard this, and Hillary Clinton? I'm not sure on the Republican side what would happen there, but does it help or hurt?
Well, it's interesting. I mean, right now the bill has just been introduced today, so I think it certainly there's a potential for certainly a candidate like Bernie Sanders, who I think recognizes this two-track justice system that we've developed in this country, to support this kind of legislation. It'll be interesting to see if he embraces it as part of his campaign dialogue. But I wouldn't be at all surprised if he integrates it into some of his campaigning efforts, because I think it resonates with the American people. The American people are tired of seeing these large corporation executives really escape any direct responsibility for these criminal actions that they've actually been responsible for.
Well, we know that the natives are restless, for the want of a better description, in terms of kind of populism on the left and the right. So it would seem to me, just in closing, that this could be an issue that people can get pretty riled up about. I mean, the lack of justice has been pretty flagrant, as far as I can see.
No, absolutely. I mean, it's certainly not going to come as a surprise, I think, to most Americans that that this kind of two-track justice system exists, and that large corporations have been getting away with this now for years. And you've mentioned a number of the examples of where that's occurred. So, and I would agree. I don't think this is necessarily a Democratic only issue. I think Republicans and independents alike, who are tired of seeing this kind of two-track system, are going to definitely feel like this is something that needs to get addressed, and that this bill is a first step in making sure that that happens.
Well, I thank you very much for joining us here today, Ronald White.
My pleasure. Thanks.
And again, I've been speaking with Ronald White, who's the Director of the Regulatory Policy at the Center for Effective Government, and he also serves in the Departments of Environmental Health Sciences, Epidemiology and Health Policy and Management at the Johns Hopkins Bloomberg School of Public Health, and he's a member of the State of Maryland's Air Quality Control Advisory Council. We're going to take a brief station break and back, talking about why Donald Trump will be the likely Republican nominee for president. Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing. And joining us now is Robert Cutton, who is the co-founder and co-editor of The American Prospect, a senior fellow at Demos, and a professor at Brandeis University's Heller School. He was formerly an assistant to the legendary I.F. Stone, a chief investigator for the Senate Banking Committee, and for 20 years wrote a column for Business Week. His books include A Presidency in Peril, The Insider Story of Obama's Promise, Wall Street's Power, and The Struggle to Control Our Economic Future. And his latest book is Debt as Prison, The Politics of Austerity versus Possibility. He has an article at the Huffington Post, Bernie Sanders is about as radical as Harry Truman. Welcome to Background Briefing, Robert Cutner.
Always a pleasure, Ian.
And your title kind of doesn't, I think, please anybody, does it? There's a certain ambiguity there. Bernie Sanders is about as radical as Harry Truman.
Well, I was trying to get people's attention. I mean, my point is that the Democratic Party in my lifetime used to be a much more progressive party. And anybody who thinks that Sanders is somehow outside the mainstream doesn't know the history of the Democratic Party. And as recently as Lyndon Johnson's domestic program, Let's Leave Aside Vietnam, the mainstream Democratic Party was very much in favor of exactly the same kind of stuff Bernie's in favor of. So Bernie only looks like a radical in comparison with where the Democratic Party has migrated to in the last three Democratic presidencies.
Well, you could almost make the case, too, that Richard Nixon, you know, who founded the EPA and offered up universal health care, and Senator Kennedy, Teddy Kennedy, didn't take him up because he thought he'd get a better deal and always regretted that. I mean, talk about how our politics have moved to the right.
The Republican Party has moved to the far right. The Democratic Party has moved to the center. And it's only against that background that Bernie Sanders looks anything other than mainstream. So to those radical supporters of Bernie's who want to think that he's a radical, maybe my title is a little bit disappointing. But my purpose was to point out that these are absolutely mainstream American progressive views, certainly going back to Franklin Roosevelt and well beyond Roosevelt.
Well, the extent to which he's getting huge crowds and money's pouring in, and after all, he's not asking for Wall Street money. He's asking for regular people, and the average donation is $31. I think he can say that it's working. I don't know how much longer it's going to work and how much greater it's going to get in terms of momentum. But surely there are people in this country who are completely in sync with the policies of Harry Truman, Jack Kennedy, and LBJ.
And Bernie Sanders. And I think back in June in the Prospect, we ran a piece that Peter Dreyer did looking hard at public opinion polls. I linked to it in the Huffington Post post, you know, pointing out that majorities of 70% and 80% of Americans support exactly the same kind of stuff that Bernie's for: much tougher regulation of Wall Street, much more progressive taxation, breaking up big banks, paid family leave, higher minimum wage, single-payer Medicare for all, unions. And it's only in comparison to where the center of gravity of American politics has been recently that Bernie Sanders looks like an outlier. He's actually very mainstream. And so I guess my takeaway is that mainstream American politics, so-called, denies Americans, for the most part, the opportunity to vote for policies that most Americans favor. And what's a little odd is that this guy, who's 74 years old, right, 5 years older than Reagan was when he was first elected, who's not your typical candidate, becomes the bearer of these popular frustrations. It just tells you just how strong these frustrations are and how broad the appeal is of someone who can articulate them as well as Sanders does. Now, you know, this brings up the inevitable question: can he be elected? And since I don't have a crystal ball, I don't know. And as somebody said, well, that's why they're having an election, to find out the answer. But we'll see.
Well, but isn't this also a reflection of how much our politics have been captured by money?
Yep.
How much the media, in effect, reflects that capture? Because after all, in our money-driven politics, what happens is politicians are turned into telemarketers. They spend all their day raising money.
Yep.
And all that money, at the end of the day, is put into television advertising, which is then all revenue for the mainstream media who profit from our broken political system.
Exactly.
So they have no incentive then. And I mean, is it? I guess this is a perfect match, isn't it? Bernie Sanders, he has contempt for the media, and they don't want to cover him.
Well, but they're kind of forced to cover him. You know, the conventional wisdom was, well, okay, he's this year's Ralph Nader, and he doesn't matter. And you know, when somebody is running ahead of Hillary in New Hampshire and raising enormous crowds and matching Hillary in terms of fundraising, but with small donors, which is much harder to do than it is when you haul it in, you know, in multi-thousand dollar checks. I mean, even the mainstream media has to start paying attention. And there was a kind of piece that I linked to in the Times, New York Times, this morning, saying, "Gee, you know, what is it with this guy?" So, it's sort of like Trump in this, and that's about the only comparison I'd make. you can't pretend that it's not happening and call yourself a journalist. So they are starting to cover him, and there's a kind of grudging respect that he's doing it with small money. He's doing it by raising by drawing huge crowds, and he's doing it by being himself, not by trimming his sails. And so, you know, the working press has to give him grudging respect. Also, it's even more interesting that, you know, he's a bit of a curmudgeon. I mean, he's a bit like Barney Frank in that sense. He's not the warmest, fuzziest person a lot of the time. And yet, even so, because he is articulating the frustration that people feel, he just has a tremendous amount of affection.
And again, I'm speaking with Robert Kuttner, who is the co-founder and co-editor of The American Prospect, a senior fellow at Demos, and a professor at Brandeis University's Heller School. He was formerly an assistant to the legendary I.F. Stone, a chief investigator for the Senate Banking Committee, and for 20 years wrote a column for Business Week. His books include A Presidency in Peril, The Insider Story of Obama's Promise, Wall Street's Power, and The Struggle to Control Our Economic Future. And his latest book is Debtor's Prison, The Politics of Austerity versus Possibility. He has an article at the Huffington Post, Bernie Sanders is about as radical as Harry Truman. So why do you think then, Robert Kuttner, that Bernie's, in spite of the, and we've discussed the sort of reluctance of the press to take him seriously, but now they're being forced to, and he's obviously very prickly with them, and he's certainly not endearing himself, but he's getting, at least getting his message out, it would seem. On the other hand, it seems that Hillary Clinton, every time she has a big speech about some policy prescription she has, Donald Trump or Ben Carson say something stupid or inflammatory or racist, and suddenly they get all the headlines. It's as though, you know, that she can't get a word in edgeways.
You know, it's really, really, really complicated. I mean, I think feminists are very upset that Hillary seems to be being held to a higher standard than male candidates would be. You know, she's a middle-of-the-road, moderate liberal Democrat. She seems to acquire all this baggage, the latest of which is, of course, the email scandal, but all the other baggage. She's yoked to Bill, which I think is a liability, because every time Bill opens his mouth, it reminds people that, you know, she's his wife rather than somebody like Elizabeth Warren, who did it the hard way. And, you know, she may well win the nomination. She's still the front runner. I mean, it's hard to picture Sanders winning primaries in more conservative states, although I would correct myself in that Democratic parties in conservative states tend to be left-wing parties, so never say never. But I guess the concern is that if she is the nominee after a long, spirited fight, is it going to be one of these deals where she staggers to the finish line and she's badly beaten up? And even though I think 99 out of 100 people who support Sanders in the primaries will, you know, will vote for Hillary in the general so that we don't get Donald Trump, there is a certain kind of intangible enthusiasm factor that he seems to have that she has less of. And it makes the general election, you know, just a whole set of wild cards where it's very hard to predict what could happen.
Well, of course, the other wild card, which we should know about any day now, is whether Vice President Biden's going to jump in the race. Just on the surface, it strikes me as yet another example of this suicidal impulse that Democrats have.
Well, also, I mean, if Biden, the idea that Biden is a kind of mainstream liberal who doesn't have Hillary's negatives, I think that's colossally naive. I mean, he's run for president twice before. He fell on his face both times. His politics aren't that different from Hillary Clinton's. If anything, they're a little bit more conservative, because now that she's no longer part of the administration, you know, she is freer to break with the administration on issues like Keystone Pipeline or for that matter, TPP, whereas Biden is stuck with being the incumbent vice president and can't be loyal to Obama. And what happens is that the kind of moderate, more corporate-oriented Democratic vote just gets divided and diluted. And so he cuts into Hillary's vote a lot more than he cuts into Bernie's if he does run. And so the idea that Biden is some kind of a savior, I think, just doesn't stand up. It makes it less likely that either Biden or Hillary would be nominated, because they'll poach support from each other. They won't poach very much. Biden won't poach very much support from Bernie. He's just not all that liberal.
Well, but, you know, the idea that Democrats are sort of salivating at the sort of insanity that's happening on the Republican side with this sort of almost know-nothing era revival going on with Trump and Carson and Fiorina and the mainstream guy that everybody thought was a shoo-in.
Yeah.
Jeb Bush, every time he opens his mouth, he like the last, just saying, you know, after the shooting in Oregon, stuff happens. That's amazing.
Yeah. I've written that I think Trump is going to be the nominee, and I'll tell you why. There's a mechanical reason why he's going to be the nominee. I mean, after March 15th, the Republican Party rules require all primaries after March 15th to be winner-take-all primaries. And if you think about who's going to stay in and who's going to get out, a lot of the second-tier Republicans who are going to get out are people whose supporters are going to gravitate to Trump. And, again, in a winner-take-all primary, Trump only has to win 25 or 30% of the votes, and he gets all the delegates. And the problem is that the other people who are going to stay in for the long term, Fiorina, Bush, probably Kasich, they're going to split the more mainstream vote. And so in primary after primary after primary, Trump's going to come in first. And under the winner-take-all rules, he gets all the delegates. So it's hard to see the race winnowing down to one single anti-Trump who could beat him in a primary. And I think the mainstream press keeps saying, well, this is a flash in the pan. It's only a matter of time. He's going to commit one more gaffe, and then he's going to start sinking in the polls. It keeps not happening because he's gaffe-proof. The crazier stuff comes out of his mouth, the more people who say, you know, that's my Donald. He's not politically correct. He says what's on his mind. And he just seems bulletproof. So, you know, then if you want to get really crazy, what would a Trump-Clinton race be like? Or even crazier, what would a Trump-Sanders race be like?
Well, I guess I'm in a different universe. I would think that it should be seen as a national disgrace that Trump becomes a nominee.
Well, of course. But, okay, so after you've perceived that, then what? Because there will be an election.
Right.
And I mean, I would like to believe that there may be 35% of the country who are know-nothings, but I don't think there's 51%.
No, well,
I mean, he's turned off women, he's turned off immigrants, he's turned off African Americans. So at some point, you've turned off more than 50% of the electorate.
So is that to say then that this will end up as a kind of Barry Goldwater type of exercise for the Republicans?
I would not want to predict that because it's such a crazy year, and if Hillary's the nominee and she is really badly damaged on the way to the nomination, it would not be a cakewalk. Turnout might be low. And I don't think Bernie Sanders is going to be nominated, but, you know, you never know. I mean, Hillary's been trumpeting this Southern strategy where after Iowa and New Hampshire, where maybe she loses, you got a string of Southern states, you got Super Tuesday, and they're allegedly more establishment parties, and she's got the super delegates. Well, on the other hand, the Democratic parties in some of these Southern states are so reduced and diminished, and biracial politics in those states, which survived for a while in the 80s and 90s, they're pretty well gone. And so you've got parties that are mostly African-American, and Bill's support among black voters, it's an open question how much that's rubbed off on Hillary and how much of it is name recognition. It's also an open question whether Sanders, who comes from a state that's 99% white, you know, can learn from Black Lives Matter and have a more effective appeal to African-American voters. So God knows it's going to be interesting.
Well, Bernie, of course, has a bit of a problem with the liberal wing of the Democratic Party, even though he's certainly got all those credentials in terms of gun control following the latest massacre in Oregon.
Yeah,
he's been sort of uncomfortably silent on that one.
Yeah, I mean, it ought to be possible if you're from a rural state to be in favor of people's right to carry ordinary hunting rifles. And not to be in favor of people's right to carry military-style assault weapons. I mean, that's not rocket science. But I mean, compared to Hillary's problems, that's relatively minor. I mean, he'll figure that out. I think, you know, if he really thinks he has a shot at being nominated, I think he's going to come around on gun control. I mean, you do one thing when you're a senator from a rural state. You do another thing when you're seriously running for president.
Well, you know, I think you're among the few people that have even broached the idea that he could make it. I mean,
I'm not. I don't want to be in that camp. I mean, it's still very, very much of a long shot. But I'm saying the people who are saying, all right, we'll give him New Hampshire. We'll even give him Iowa. But then, you know, it's grown up time. It's more complicated than that. I mean, he comes out of those two states. If he actually pulls that off, he comes out of those two states with an enormous amount of momentum, and then that's a moment when Elizabeth Warren has to decide whether her time has come. You know, Bernie has shown that Hillary's vulnerable, but maybe he can't win, or maybe he certainly can't win the general, so maybe Elizabeth gets in. I mean, I think, there's a dynamic to these things. And it's very easy for Hillary Clinton to say now, well, I have this wall of primaries in the South and I'm just going to win. But just imagine what it would be like to wake up losing both Iowa and New Hampshire. It just transforms the whole psychology of the race.
Well, but that's not far-fetched at this stage.
Not at all.
Bernie's certainly got New Hampshire wrapped up, hasn't he?
Looks like. And, you know, Iowa is a very left-wing caucus state.
Right.
So I think... I mean, we're taking at the prospect. I don't want to give away trade secrets here, but you know, we're taking a much deeper look at the next round of primaries and asking the question whether Hillary Clinton can take these for granted. And I think the answer is no. That doesn't mean Bernie's going to win, but it means that it's somewhat more open than some folks think.
So you're talking about starting with South Carolina.
Yeah.
And then Super Tuesday.
Yep. I mean, these are conservative states with very few white Democrats. And so the question is, where are the African-American Democrats in these states?
Well, boy, wouldn't a Sanders-Trump race be an absolute repudiation of punditry?
Well, I worry that anything could happen.
Right.
You know, I mean, I worry that, and don't forget, you got a 69-year-old against a 70, he's going to be 75 on Election Day, Bernie. I mean, that's old.
Right.
That's old. In fact, 70's old to run for president.
Right.
Trump's going to be 70. So you got, a revolutionary upsurge personified by two geriatric cases, right? So that's really bizarre. And I would be much happier if somebody who were a little bit more plausible. I also worry about anti-Semitism coming out of the closet. I mean, it's amazing to me that somebody who was a Jewish transplant from Brooklyn to Vermont has gotten as far as he's gotten. Now, granted, there's not much anti-Semitism on the left wing of the Democratic Party. There's some anti-Israel feeling in the context of Palestinian issue, but it's not traditional anti-Semitism. You know, you got a lot of really nasty anti-Semites in this country. What's that going to be like? So that would be an incredibly weird election. Another question is, since Sanders is quite serious about really reigning in Wall Street, what the heck does Wall Street do if that's the choice? Because Trump has said some nasty things about Wall Street, too. So what do? Do they try and, you know, come up with some kind of third-party centrist?
Well, in terms of Bernie's being Jewish, does anybody notice that, or does it matter? He's obviously very secular.
Oh, sure, because anti-Semites don't care whether you're observant. They view Judaism as a race, not a religious preference. And if he were to be the nominee, you would see a kind of flourishing of anti-Semitism of the sort that you haven't seen since the Lindbergh campaign.
Well, that's not a very pleasant prospect. But,
no.
But
so this could be a wild year. I mean, I'm not. Please let me be clear about this. I'm not predicting that Bernie's going to be nominated. I am predicting that he's going to give Hillary a rougher time than some people think. And I'm not even 100% predicting that Trump is going to be nominated. But if you do the arithmetic and you look at the logic of primaries, I think the people in the mainstream press are saying, well, you know, this is a flash in the pan. He can never be nominated. I think they're very premature.
But if Hillary were to survive, and you say by the time she gets there, once she's the nominee and then starts the race, she's going to be pretty damaged. And furthermore, she's looking tired already, frankly. And my understanding,
I thought she looked terrific on Saturday Night Live.
That's true, she did. But I've on the stump a few times. I mean,
she is.
Remember, she wanted to rest after that bruising campaign with Obama, and apparently Bill says, "No, honey, we got to be in the game," and pushed her into being Secretary of State. And that was a pretty grueling experience. And she hasn't really had much of a rest, so. But assuming she gets there, wouldn't the fact that Trump has alienated so many people, and what's the division between men and women? I mean, almost every.
Oh, and look, if it's Hillary versus Trump, Hillary wins.
That's what I think. Yeah.
Me too. Yeah. So, but she's a lot has to happen between now and her claiming the nomination.
So, and then if that were to happen, what would she do with Bernie? How would she win the left back?
Well, you know, there has been a kind of tacit truce. They have not really been very harsh on each other because they know they're going to need each other.
Well, that does seem to be the case. But I mean,
yeah.
In terms of traditional politics, is there? I mean, he's not going to want to be Secretary of Labor, for God's sake.
No, he might just want to stay in the Senate.
I see. Well, this is a very I've enjoyed this conversation.
Me too.
Very interesting.
Well, it's a great spectator sport. It's too bad that this is our country we're talking about.
You mean the country's going to be collateral damage?
Yeah.
Oh, Lord. All righty. Well,
always a pleasure.
Thank you so much.
Thank you. Cheers.
Cheers. And again, I've been speaking with Robert Cutt, who's the co-founder and co-editor of The American Prospect, a senior fellow at Demos and a professor at Brandeis University's Heller School. He was formerly an assistant to the legendary I.F. Stone, a chief investigator for the Senate Banking Committee, and for 20 years wrote a column for Business Week. His books include A Presidency in Peril, The Insider Story of Obama's Promise, Wall Street's Power, and The Struggle to Control Our Economic Future. And his latest book is Debtor's Prison, The Politics of Austerity versus Possibility. He has an article at the Huffington Post, Bernie Sanders is about as radical as Harry Truman. We're going to take a brief station break. We're back examining the legacy of Arne Duncan, who just stepped down as Secretary of Education. Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing. And joining us now is David Halperin, who's a senior fellow at Republic Report. He was previously founding director of the Campus Progress and senior vice president at the Center for American Progress, senior policy advisor for Howard Dean's presidential campaign, founding executive director of the American Constitution Society, White House speechwriter and special assistant for national security affairs to President Clinton, and counsel to the Senate Intelligence Committee. He has an article at the Huffington Post, Report Exposes For-Profit College Abuses in Converting to Nonprofits. Welcome to Background Briefing, David Halperin.
Thanks, Ian.
And the outgoing Secretary of Education had quite a farewell in the White House. Obviously, there's a bit of a bromance going on there between Obama and Arne Duncan, and
yes,
they're extremely affectionate towards each other. But now that he's moved on and he's been replaced by his deputy, who has an interesting life story, which he managed to talk a little bit about, what do you think his legacy is? Because we've talked a lot about this outrageous racket that goes on where $30-plus billion of taxpayer money goes to these predatory for-profit colleges that saddle these aspiring students with a lifetime of debt and give them worthless diplomas. And unfortunately, that is more often the case than not. And this is not hyperbole. So this is an outrage, and I don't understand why Arne Duncan apparently did nothing about it.
Well, I wouldn't say he did nothing about it. Most of his legacy is on the side of K-12 education. That's where his background, that was his interest. But he got pulled into this fight, and I would say it was kind of a roller coaster, kind of an erratic performance. I think originally he was willing to let the staff, particularly under Deputy Undersecretary of Education Bob Shireman, a friend of mine, take some strong steps to try to rein in the abuses of this industry, which has been lying to students, lying to the government, and just abusing our taxpayers and ruining students' lives. But eventually, as these regulatory reforms went forward to try to curb the bad schools, the lobbyists came in, Democrats and Republicans hired, and millions of dollars were spent to try to pressure Congress and pressure the Department of Education, the White House, not to get tough on these bad schools. And I think at some point, Secretary Duncan seemed a little nervous and worried that he would be exposed and attacked as, you know, abusing the private sector here, even though this private sector was getting 90% of their money from taxpayers, and he had every right to demand that they perform and help students. At some point, though, it looks like the industry went too far and pissed Secretary Duncan off, and then he started to say very aggressive things, that he was tired of their abuses, and he was tired of Congress, members of Congress, being owned by this industry, and the regulation got a little tougher, and he got a little tougher. But after Corinthian Colleges, the worst of the chains failed, it appears, and Duncan had to deal with the fallout of a lot of students asking for their money back and their federal loans to be forgiven. It looks like now Duncan is maybe potentially worried about more schools failing and all kinds of students literally being left out in the cold, and it looks a little hesitant to do what he ought to do, which is to let the bad chains fail, because otherwise they are continuing to take our tax money and continuing to sign up students for programs that will ruin their lives. So I just described kind of an up-and-down roller coaster ride that we've taken with the secretary. He saw the problem, but he hasn't been ready to pull the trigger on doing everything that's necessary to hold them accountable.
And what percentage of his budget, of the Department of Education's budget, goes to these for-profit colleges?
I actually don't know the answer to that. But for-profit colleges, in terms of federal financial aid, have been getting about $30 billion a year, and that's about a quarter of the federal financial aid budget of about $120 billion for higher ed. I don't know how much the budget is for K-12 aid, but it's substantially more, I assume.
Well, but that's a useful statistic, about a quarter of what is spent on higher education, and that's what these colleges are about. So
that's right, and not only that, that quarter of the budget's only for about 13% of the students. So they're getting a large percentage per student of the federal financial aid, and they accounted for nearly half of the loan defaults. So in fact, it ended up costing more because the students in other sectors were more likely to be paying back their loans eventually to the government.
So in terms then of his inability to do anything about it, or reluctance to take it on head on, but as you say later on, he got so fed up with them because they did. There were many efforts on the part of the White House to bring in rules. They got lobbied and lobbied and lobbied. This sounds like more of a story of how Washington works than anything else.
I think that's right. And I think that the this industry was so rich but also so dependent on taxpayer money that they had a huge incentive to spend it on lobbying. So who did they hire as their lobbyists? Not just Trent Lott, the former Republican leader, but they hired Anita Dunn, who'd been President Obama's communications advisor. She represented Kaplan, and she helped them plan a strategy to undermine President Obama and Secretary Duncan's initiative on for-profit colleges. And then after she did that, she was rehired by President Obama to be the communications advisor on his 2012 campaign. So that's just how Washington works. All kinds of big Democrats were on the payroll of for-profit colleges because Democrats are used to lobby Democrats and Republicans are used to lobby Republicans. And it's been a sad story, one of the worst I've seen in the city, where something so wrong, so nakedly abusive of students and taxpayers continued to be financed and is continued to be financed. There's not all the for-profit colleges are bad, but many of them are, and the Department of Education has more than ample regulations to shut down schools for lying to students and for lying to the government, for not being financially responsible and having enough money, as in the case of Corinthian, to pay back people if they failed. So it's a real blatant failure, and in fact, it's far from over. All the industry's reputation is in tatters. They're just hanging on, waiting for somebody like Jeb Bush, who's praised the industry, again praised them last year, went to their conference and got $55,000 to make a speech praising the industry, or Donald Trump, who himself owns a for-profit college, unaccredited, but still. They may be able to hang on, and this may be a bad period for the industry, but it's possible that they will come back to their old predatory ways, or they're trying new strategies like I wrote about today, a new study showing how blatantly they are turning into nonprofit colleges, but nonprofit colleges that are basically structured as a personal piggy bank for the owner of the former for-profit college.
Now, let's get into your report, or the report by your colleague Bob Shimon. Tell me more.
Well, for-profit colleges started to realize that the writing might be on the wall, that it was going to get tougher for them. There's a rule that they can only receive 90% of their revenue from Department of Education money, which sounds like an awful lot, but so few people are willing to pay their own money to go to these schools because they're so poor quality that they have trouble making that. That only applies to for-profit colleges. Also, for-profit colleges have to pay taxes, nonprofit don't. And nonprofit colleges can claim and do claim now, given the reputation of for-profit colleges, that they're nonprofit colleges and you should go there. So a few colleges got the idea and a bunch of lawyers started pitching themselves that we can help you do these conversions. But a nonprofit organization is not supposed to be there for the enrichment of one person. It's supposed to be there to serve the public interest and to serve a public mission. But the way these deals have been structured, in a couple of examples, the owner received an enormous overvaluation of the college, that it was worth a lot based on especially its goodwill, even though these colleges have bad will. They've got bad reputations. And so in one case, the owner received a valuation that the college was worth about $630 million. I think $400 million of that was goodwill. The owner then basically made a loan to the new nonprofit that was taking over the college, and a charitable contribution of a piece of it. And now the owner is being paid millions of dollars a year by the nonprofit. And the owner, in this case, of a school, of a company, the school's called Stevens Henniger and College America. The owner's named Carl Barney, is now the sole member of the nonprofit. He can fire the other board members. He can do whatever he wants. So the nonprofit is basically structured to benefit this one person, Carl Barney, who was getting rich off the for-profit, now getting rich off the nonprofit. It's now tax-exempt, advertises nonprofit, and it's a school that is under investigation, being sued by the Justice Department and the state of Colorado for defrauding students. But it's our newest nonprofit college, and there's a real threat that this trend, which is now extended to at least four former for-profit colleges, and others are thinking about it, could sort of pollute the whole concept of what a nonprofit college is. But the IRS, the Internal Revenue Service, has asked these schools for a number of different assurances that would prevent it from being that kind of a corrupt enterprise. The owners have provided the assurances, and then particularly in the case of Kaiser University, a politically powerful owner in Florida, Art Kaiser, have basically broken those promises in the same way that I just described basically for College America and Carl Barney, broken the promises, perverted the idea of a nonprofit. But the IRS is standing by, not doing anything about it, and the Department of Education, which also needs to approve the new form of ownership as eligible for federal aid, also hasn't done anything. I will say the Department of Education recently has expressed interest in this, particularly after a front-page story appeared in the New York Times earlier this year, which quoted my colleague Bob Shireman, who's since done some more detailed research on this. And it's potentially, it's a possibility now the Department of Education will get tougher on this.
But let me get this straight there, David Halpern. This person who's getting rich off having gone from a for-profit college to a non-profit college, which I take it would be a 501c3 IRS
yes.
vehicle, and then he's diverted almost all the money into his own pocket. But at the end of the day, doesn't 99% of this money come from the taxpayer? So not only is the taxpayer making this guy rich, he's also being able to cheat the IRS at the same time.
Yes. The law is they can get up to 90% of their money from Department of Education aid, and that doesn't even count the veterans, the Department of Veterans Affairs, and Department of Defense aid that can go to our veterans and service members. So it can be slightly more than 90% of the aid comes from taxpayers, and you know, it's possible they could cheat the basically abuse the nonprofit structure and get rich, but actually still be helping students by providing a good education. In the case of College America and the schools owned by Carl Barney, they're clearly a very bad predatory school. Kaiser might be slightly better educational quality, but they still spend much less on instruction than your average. 9 out of 10 nonprofit colleges spend more than 50% of their revenue on instruction, on teaching, on paying professors and providing classrooms. College America, the Carl Barney schools, have been spending about 15% of their revenue on instruction, and the Kaiser schools about 30%, so much less than normal nonprofit colleges have been spending to help students train for careers and get an education.
But don't these for-profits and now the spin-off nonprofits, don't they spend a lot of their money on, which comes from the taxpayer again, on advertising? You see ads for all of these new schools on TV all the time popping up.
They spend an enormous amount of their money on TV ads, bus ads, radio ads, and also a very insidious practice, which both of these schools, or at least I know that the College America schools are connected to, I'm not so sure about Kaiser, on using these horrible bait-and-switch things that I've written about before, where they will post fake job ads, people desperate for jobs, or ads for home heating assistance, food stamps, things poor people want. When you go to the website, instead, you are prompted to put in your information before you can get the information. There's actually no information on those topics. There's just a call center someplace in Utah or Florida that's going to start calling you and trying to use a deceptive pitch to get you to sign up for worthless for-profit education programs. So their marketing is not just expensive, it's downright insidious and criminal, in fact, fraudulent. And so that is what a lot of our taxpayer money is going to. Also things like, of course, paying for the stadium in Arizona, where the pro football stadium, where the Super Bowl was played, is called the University of Phoenix Stadium, even though the University of Phoenix has no football team. What it has is a ton of your tax money to pay for advertising. University of Phoenix, also the number one advertiser on Google until recently.
So back to Arnie Duncan and his legacy then. You mentioned earlier that David Halpern, that he did sort of wake up a little bit and try to take them on, but they are so, these for-profit colleges who are subsidized by the taxpayer and by the Department of Defense and Veteran Affairs, because, and this is the even worse, that they not only do they gull young kids from minority communities trying to aspire to a better life and a better job, but they also go after vets as well and indenture them with a lifetime of debt and a worthless diploma. Wasn't Arnie Duncan also a little bit behind the curve on student debt issues that I mean, that's a huge issue in itself, the extent to which the Fed over these last decade or so, where you had almost zero interest rates, the Fed's been basically giving banks money at about 0.25%, and then these banks have then turned around and charged money to student loans between 6% and 7%. That's just pure profit.
That is troubling. But what's worse, what was going on before, up until 2010, for decades, the loans had been made by banks that received a subsidy from the feds to make the loans. Even though the banks incurred no risk, they weren't actually a lender, because in the end, the taxpayer had the risk if the student defaulted on the loan. So it was a massive, massive handout to banks who participated in the federal student loan program. And President Obama and Secretary Duncan and Bob Shireman, the person who wrote the article we've been talking about, or the report, they worked to get rid of that, and the banks lobbied furiously because it was free money from the taxpayer. So at least now the rates are the same, but the money's going back to the Treasury, and it can be used. It's not being used for a party or a yacht. It's being used to support federal student aid and programs of the Department of Education. But there is an argument that Elizabeth Warren and others have made forcefully that instead the students should just simply be charged less, and the federal aid therefore should be greater, and the loan interest rates should come down.
Well, it certainly would make sense in terms of, I don't think we've ever had this situation before where the younger generation, before they even get a job, are saddled with a lifetime of debt.
Yes.
That just seems to be cruel and unusual punishment for the young generation, particularly in a very soft job market to begin with.
Well, and you know, the part of the problem, of course, is skyrocketing tuition. College tuitions keep going up. And the Pell Grant, the amount of money that was given as a grant rather than a loan, buys a very small amount now of an average college tuition compared with what it did 40 years ago. So there are huge problems in trying to figure out how to help young people, particularly low-income people, pay for college, and how to ensure that the programs they go to are actually helping them build careers. Unfortunately, a huge amount of time and energy has been wasted over the last, during this administration, fighting these intransigent, frankly disgusting, contemptible for-profit colleges. It should be a no-brainer that there ought to be strong rules in place to make sure that if these colleges are getting money, they're helping students. Instead, they fought that tooth and nail. There are hard questions about how we do higher education policy and help people build careers, and we've just wasted huge amounts of time, energy, and everything on this stupid debate that basically a bunch of rich entitled people have forced on us.
Well, I thank you very much for joining us here today, David Halpern.
Thank you, Ian.
And again, I've been speaking with David Halpern, who's a senior fellow at the Republic Report. He was previously founding director of Campus Progress and senior vice president at the Center for American Progress, senior policy advisor for Howard Dean's presidential campaign, founding executive director of the American Constitution Society, White House speechwriter and special assistant for national security affairs to President Clinton, and counsel to the Senate Intelligence Committee. He has an article at the Huffington Post, "Report Exposes For-Profit College Abuses in Converting to Nonprofits." This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon. This program is available for podcasting at ianmasters.com, where you can scroll down on the right-hand side to subscribe to iTunes podcasts. And I'll be back again tomorrow with another Background Briefing. Bye for now.